This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends. David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It would honestly be hard to overstate the role that Al Gore has played in making us aware of the climate crisis and in making it seem vivid, making it seem real. When he was elected vice president in 1992, Gore was one of the only national politicians who really put climate change at the top of the agenda. Though the right wing tried to stereotype him as a tree-hugging hippie, Gore was firmly in the establishment, a former senator from a political family in Tennessee. Gore had about him a wooden earnestness that occasionally made him the butt of jokes on Saturday Night Live and the like. But by the time the film An Inconvenient Truth came out in 2006, a film that documented his long effort to gain support for climate action, the jokes had really faded. Gore shared a Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 for his efforts, and he founded an investment firm dedicated to sustainability. And now, after the hottest summer in recorded history, his quest seems more urgent than ever. The UN's annual conference on climate change begins next month. So I wanted to talk to Al Gore about how far we've come in the fight against climate change and how far we still have to go.
Great.
Hey, David, how are you?
Nice to see you.
Well, here we are. The last time I saw you, you came to The New Yorker and Condé Nast to talk about climate. This was probably 10 years ago. And you were in the mode of warning, pushing, just as you had even years before with An Inconvenient Truth. And now we're through the summer of 2023, when I think anybody has to recognize that this is not a matter of the future. This is a matter of now. The climate crisis is now. We're living in it. How do you assess what you saw, what we all saw in the summer all across the world?
Well, as you say, it now seems obvious to almost everyone that the severity of the crisis has reached a new level of intensity, with the climate-related extreme events becoming so common. And we know how to solve it. We have the means to solve it. I've used the metaphor of flipping a switch, and some people have objected to that, but really we have a switch we can flip.
Describe what the switch is and what the political means are, and what stands in the way of flipping the switch.
The climate crisis is really a fossil fuel crisis. There are other components of it for sure, but 80% of it is the burning of fossil fuels. And 80% of the energy powering the world economy is still coming from fossil fuels. So it's no easy task to unwind that. But here's what the metaphor of the switch is based on. The scientists now know, and this is a relatively new finding, a very firm understanding, that once we stop net additions to the overburden of greenhouse gases, once we reach so-called net zero, the temperatures on Earth will stop going up almost immediately, like flipping a switch. The lag time is as little as 3 to 5 years. They used to think it would keep on going because of positive feedback loops, and some things tragically will. The melting of the ice, for example, has been triggered and will continue, though we can moderate the pace of that. The extinction crisis will continue without other major changes, but we can stop temperatures going up almost immediately. That's the switch we need to flip. And then we can start the long and slow healing process almost immediately if we act.
What's required?
We have to find a way to shift out of our dependence on fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas. And of course, the fossil fuel industry for more than 100 years built up a legacy network of political and economic influence, lobbying and campaign contributions, and the revolving door phenomena where fossil fuel executives go into the government. I mean, the last president made the CEO of ExxonMobil the Secretary of State. It's almost hard to believe. But that is a symbol of how they have penetrated governments around the world. When ExxonMobil or Chevron put their ads on the air, the purpose is not for a husband and wife to say, "Oh, let's go down to the store and buy some motor oil." the purpose is to condition the political space so that they have a continued license to keep producing and selling more and more fossil fuels.
Well, you're not only an evangelist for climate change; you also are a politician, a seasoned politician.
I'm a recovering politician.
You're looking better already. Tell me why. Why is it impossible for politicians not to run on this successfully? What do you counsel politicians, and why is it so hard?
It's so hard because the polluters have gained such a degree of control over the processes of self-government. I've often said that in order to solve the climate crisis, we have to pay a lot of attention to the democracy crisis. Our representative democracy is not working very well. You know, when I first went into the Congress in the mid-70s, I never even had a fundraiser. the average congressman spends at least an average of 5 hours a day on the telephone and at cocktail parties and dinners, begging lobbyists for money to finance their campaigns.
It seems to me that until alternative energy sources are cheap enough and ubiquitous enough to overcome the price and ubiquity of fossil fuels, you're always going to have a problem. No, Bill McKibben will argue, as you do, I think, that those sources of energy are around, and no matter what you may think of Elon Musk as a matter of character, that electric cars are on their way. Which stage are we in? And you're involved in the investment end of things as well. How far away are we from, in technological terms and financial terms, of being able to overwhelm fossil fuels?
Well, we're getting closer and closer. Globally, 88% of all the new electricity generation last year was from renewables, 80% from solar and wind. More money is now going into renewables than to fossil fuels. But the base of fossil fuel generation is so large, it continues. That's the number one market for fossil fuels, electricity generation. The second one is the one you touched upon with electric vehicles. And yes, Elon Musk single-handedly advanced the distribution of electric vehicles by 15, 20 years. Really quite a remarkable
story. You give him a lot of credit.
Oh, of course.
Are you troubled by Elon Musk as a tribune for the cause?
Well, sure, sure. I mean, I have known him for a long time, and some other of his longtime friends, I have been puzzled and concerned by the U-turn he's taken on some very fundamental issues. But back to the narrative you've explored here. All of the big auto companies have long since shifted their R&D budgets and their focus to trying to compete in the electric vehicle space. It will be a bumpy transition, but it's well underway.
So how do you do that from the White House, from Congress. What do you want to see Joe Biden do? And can he do it? Does he have the political and rhetorical capacity to do it effectively the way you want to see?
What Joe Biden did last year in passing the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which is really a climate bill, was the most extraordinary legislative achievement of any head of state in any country in history. However, we are still permitting fossil fuel production on public lands. We can't control private lands. We could bring it to a halt on public lands. What would be the political cost for him doing that? Significant. It can't be blinked away because, again, the influence of the fossil fuel industry is quite significant. They have taken over one of our two major political parties, Lock, Stock, and Oil Barrel. It's really quite shocking. But as someone wrote, Mother Nature is staging an intervention, and I think we're quite close to crossing a political tipping point. Now, the economist, to a person, will say that a carbon price is essential, whether in the form of a tax or a fee or whatever, but it's seen as a political
death.
I have the scars to prove it. I succeeded in January of 1993 persuading the incoming Clinton Gore administration to put a carbon tax in our first budget proposal. And it passed the House of Representatives and then was killed in the Senate. A decade and more later, Barack Obama succeeded in getting a so-called cap and trade, which is an indirect price on carbon, passed by the House, and again it died in the Senate. I think we're close to seeing a carbon tax. Look, at the African Climate Summit, the first ever, the leaders in Africa said, we've got to have a carbon tax, and we need to devote the money to helping developing countries gain access to private capital markets so they can participate in this clean energy revolution. They've been walled off from it.
I'm speaking with former Vice President Al Gore. Next month, nearly 200 countries will join the UN's annual climate conference, a meeting that's known as COP, Conference of the Parties. And the members will assess how the globe is doing on the goal of the Paris Agreement to keep temperature rise this century below 2 degrees Celsius. Yet another climate summit is coming up, this time in the Middle East.
Yeah.
It seems odd who's leading it. How do you feel about that?
They have named the head of their national oil company, Sultan Al Jaber, as president of the conference. I think it's...
what does that pretend?
Well, I think that it takes off a disguise that has masked the reality for quite some time. It's absurd to put the CEO of one of the largest and, by many measures, least responsible oil and gas companies in the world in charge of the climate conference. In Glasgow, the fossil fuel delegates outnumbered the largest national delegation. They have dominated this UN process the same way they've dominated so many state governments in the U.S. and the national government much of the time. And it goes back to the weakness of the United Nations as an institution. It has been that way since its creation. It's the best we've got, so we have to make the best of it. COP1, the first of these annual conferences, took place 3 years after the Earth Summit in Berlin. The young environment minister of Germany, Angela Merkel, was the president of COP1. First order of business was to adopt the rules, including the rules for how the world's going to make decisions. What are the voting rules? Saudi Arabia objected. The U.S. coal industry helped organize opposition, among others. Their chief lobbyist at that time, Don Perlman, worked hand in glove with the Saudi Arabian government. So the rules were not adopted. The default procedure was something called consensus, which is the same as unanimity unless the president of the COP recognizes someone who is trying to object. If some Pacific Island nation like Vanuatu is in the back of the vast hall waving his hand, they may not see him. If Saudi Arabia is waving both arms in the front row, then they say, oh, sorry, we don't have permission from this petrostate to act. And so the petrostates, and in effect the fossil fuel industry, has had a veto over anything the world community tries to do on fossil fuels. Even the great Paris Agreement, which was a genuine achievement, could not use the phrase fossil fuels. And last year, there was a movement by the European Union and others to have a resolution to phase out fossil fuels, to begin the phase out. Saudi Arabia said, no, I'm sorry, we won't permit that. You have to have our permission, and we will not grant you our permission. Sorry, world, we can't even talk about fossil fuels. It's insane. It's utterly insane. Now, we can change those rules. I've spent a lot of time with the international lawyers who understand all this. Three-quarters of the nations could vote to change the rules and give a supermajority the political power to adopt binding resolutions. It's a tough challenge for sure, but we have to do it, and we have to find a way to do it. Even if a supermajority of the nations gained the ability to pass binding resolutions, they're not really binding if nations like Russia or Saudi Arabia or the U.S. want to just ignore them. But we can establish the so-called direction of travel. We can establish a new and strong consensus in the world that in order to save humanity's future, we have to phase out fossil fuels. I'm not saying it's easy. It's not easy. It's the toughest thing humanity has ever tried to do.
You live in a, most of the time, or some of the time, in a bluish city in a red state. Mm. You live in Nashville and Tennessee, obviously. Mm-hmm. Have you made inroads politically to your ear since you've started campaigning on this issue so many years ago in a place like Tennessee?
Oh, sure. Yeah, yes.
And how can you quantify it?
Well, the young Republicans are aghast at their elders' troglodytic positions on climate. Nashville, by the way, just elected a very progressive, highly intelligent mayor. But there's no doubt that the state legislature, reflecting the politics of the state as a whole, is still in the hip pocket of the fossil fuel industry. But out in the countryside, out in the 95 counties of Tennessee, people are coming around on this, of course. Farmers have seen these incredibly devastating weather events disrupt planting, disrupt harvesting. Small towns have been destroyed. Waverly, Tennessee, west of Nashville, had one of these rain bombs. I can go through the list. It's all over the country, all over the world now, and it is beginning to wake people up.
Reality has its effect.
Reality eventually has its effect, but we're in a race against time, and you know,
aren't we losing that race miserably?
I would define it in different terms. Yes, we are. The crisis is still getting worse faster than we are implementing the solutions. However, we are gaining momentum, and we're gaining momentum so rapidly that I'm convinced we will soon be gaining on the crisis itself.
Is that your natural optimism speaking, or is it the facts? They back you up.
Well, I am temperamentally optimistic.
Because if I ask Elizabeth Culbert that, I get quite a different answer. She does everything she can to prevent despair, which is the unforgivable sin, but it creeps in.
Well, the old cliche, denial ain't just a river in Egypt, should be joined by despair ain't just a tire in the trunk. despair is just another form of climate denial. We don't have time for it. Just look at the climate migrants. There's so many examples of this already. People from Central America coming through Mexico to the southern border of the U.S., that's driven by climate. The Lancet Commission, widely respected, says in this century we may have 1 billion climate migrants crossing international borders. That could threaten our capacity for self-governance. There are obstacles to move out of the way.
Well, you mentioned democracy early on. It is well known, at least to people of a certain age, that after challenging the results in 2000, you painfully, elegantly, and with grace conceded. You stepped away, and George Bush became president. We saw what we saw in January 6th, and now we face the possibility of that possibly being a permanent condition, something that could happen over and over again, the way we're now seeing impeachment as a kind of political weapon being used in the Republican House. You were prescient about the environmental crisis. Did the crisis of democracy take you by surprise?
No. I wrote a book called The Assault on Reason in 2007. Mm-hmm. It began with a notation that many Americans were asking the question, what has happened to to America? It has been building for quite some time. But I think that the love people have for freedom, for self-determination, and for self-government is reawakening, and people are—
You think it'll prevail?
I do. Again, I'm temperamentally optimistic. We don't have time to wallow in despair. We've got work to do, and the stakes have never been higher. It relies upon the willingness of the American people to wake up and fight to save our democracy and to save the future of humanity. This all sounds so dire, but it is.
Necessary. Vice President Al Gore, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Former Vice President Al Gore is now the chairman and founder of the Climate Reality Project. He shared a Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. The United Nations COP28 conference begins in November. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In the world of salsa music, Ruben Blades is one of the greats. His 1978 album, Siembra, a word that means planting or cultivating, remains one of the best-selling salsa albums of all time. Me fui pa'l monte buscando
guayaba. Ruben Blades, or as we call him in Latin America, Ruben Blades, though his name is actually Ruben Blades, is one of the most important figures in salsa.
Graciela Mochkowski writes for The New Yorker about Latin American politics and culture.
He's an incredibly prolific artist, a writer, a singer, an activist, and a Hollywood actor.
Hi, my name is Rudy Veloz, and I have this music that is going to blow you away.
I grew up in Argentina, and he really sings for an entire people. We all feel like Blades' or Blades' songs are speaking about the struggles of our own countries. It's not about Panama or Latinos in New York. It's really about all of us. 45 years ago, he released his very first really big album, Siembra, that he recorded with Willie Colon, who was at the center of the salsa movement then. And it was the first album that really brought salsa outside of New York and outside of the U.S. and Latin America to the world. Now you can, you know, there's salsa, the salsa movement is very much alive and vibrant in Israel, in Taiwan, in Japan. You know, you could say that Ruben Blades or Blades sort of did for salsa music what Bob Marley did for reggae. And he really brought it into the global consciousness.
Blades just finished up a summer tour, and he's been working on a memoir. Graciela Mochkowski sat down to talk with Blades about his life in music, politics, and acting.
Okay, pues empecemos. Buenas tardes.
Muy buenas tardes.
So I always start at the beginning. So I wanted to start in 1969, when you were 21, and you came to New York City for the first time. And in that trip, you recorded what I believe was your first album, From Panama to New York, De Panamá a Nueva York, with Pete Rodriguez and his orchestra. Let's listen for a moment to a song from that album, just to get a sense of what it sounded like. Esta tierra que nos vio nacer, a que nos cubrirá después. So tell us about that album and where it came from.
As anything and most of the things in my life, it came as a result of a total unexpected occurrences. I had quit music by that time because the dean of the law school in Panama asked me if I was going to be a musician or a lawyer, because somebody saw me playing at a private house with a band called Los Salvajes del Ritmo, and the professor went and told the dean that he had seen me, and that he didn't think that that was a good idea to have a student singing on the weekends.
So was this a very conservative environment?
Yes, it was very, 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 very strict. So anyway, then a friend of mine that was a musician, Francisco Buckley, the first recording studio ever to have been built in Panama, Discos Ismeños, had asked him to come with his band and perform to make sure that everything was in its right position to record. So Bush, knowing that I sang, called me and asked me to be a part of the group, and I said, I can't do that. And he said, no, this is a private thing. There's nobody, no one's going to be there. And it's just a band. Please help us with this. And I said, well, I'll go and help as a backup. I went. The owner of the record label had brought somebody from New York called Pancho Cristal, which was one of the biggest producers in New York at the time, to supervise the happenings. The band was three horns in the rhythm section, so eight people. One or two of the guys got lost, so they couldn't play the arrangements. So that required then improvisation. Benito Guardia, who was the piano player for Bush, said, Ruben, you like, you know, let's do El Raton, which was a very popular song from Cheo Feliciano at the time. And I did it. Pancho Cristal was at that moment in the cabin, and when he heard my voice, he ran out and went to me because at that time my voice sounded very much like the sound of the voice of Jose Cheo Feliciano, who was a recording star. And he was stunned. And he asked me if I ever wanted to, you know, record an album. And I said, nah, not now. I can't do music, you know. The thing is, he said, look, if you ever get to New York, call me. And he gave me his number. Then, in Panama, in 1968, we had had the military coup. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things they did, the military did, was to close, shut down the university. Now, my mother was very afraid that I was going to join any of the movements. And
as a guerrilla, como guerrillero.
She was concerned that I was going to join. So she came up with this notion, like, if I wanted a holiday, I remember for my birthday, she wanted to send me to New York. And I called Pancho Cristal, that producer that I had met the year before. And then he said, oh, yeah, come over and I'll record you. Then we recorded this basically salsa album, and that's how this album got done. I left New York, went back to Panama. The university was reopened. I went back to law school.
And you finished your degree there.
I finished my degree. I never got involved in music again until the album came out, I believe, in 1970.
Yes.
I didn't even know about it when it came out.
It didn't come out in Panama. It only came out here.
In Panama, it was released in Panama. You know, the first song of the album was a song I had written about a guerrilla fighter who is murdered by the army.
Juan González.
So I thought, in order not to be arrested, I thought I can deflect the whole notion by saying that these events were occurring in a mythical place. So I said, la historia que van a escuchar está basada en hechos ficticios. You know, this is all fiction. I'm doing this. This is fiction. Cualquier semejanza con persona viva o muerta es pura coincidencia. Any, if this looks like Che Guevara, it's just a coincidence.
So you didn't settle in New York then. As you said, you came back to Panama.
Yes.
You got your law degree. But you ended up coming back to the U.S. in 1973 to Florida, where your parents
74.
Were. 74.
My father was accused of, by Noriega, who was then a colonel. He was accused by Manuel Antonio Noriega, my father being involved in a plot to kill him.
Oh, wow.
So my family, my mother took my family.
Was that the truth?
I don't think so. I don't think it was the truth, but my father was a detective. He was working with the DEA. DEA had just started.
Well,
so the DEA was using my father in Panama as a contact and investigator because my father was one of the few Panamanian detectives who spoke English.
Right.
And so the fact that I think the DEA was closing in on Noriega made him want to get rid of it. So in 1974, I graduated from law school. I was working with people in jail at the time. I finished my thesis. I presented it, and I was approved. And I decided to leave because I seen no point of being a lawyer under a military dictatorship. So I went to Florida, and my family was having a lot of trouble. My mother was working in Florida. My father could not get a job. I had three small brothers. My diploma was not accepted by the Florida bar. So I didn't know what to do. I felt useless. I didn't know what to do. And then all of a sudden, I thought of calling Fania Records, which was the biggest salsa label at the time.
A great big hand for the Fania All-Stars, everybody.
And I called and I offered myself as a writer and a singer. And they said no to both. And then I said, well, do you have any jobs? And then they said, well, as a matter of fact, we just had an opening today in the mail office. And I said, well, what does that mean? What are the chores? They explained it to me. And I said, I'll take it. But when Barreto's band broke for the second time, Tito Allen, a wonderful, great local singer, left the band, Barreto had to find another singer. So somebody told him that I sang. And then he came to the mailroom to ask me if it was true that I sang. And then he sort of interrogated me for like a while, for like an hour, like trying to understand what it was that I was doing there. And finally, he gave me a date for an audition. And I went. He hired Tito Gomez, who had been working with La Sonora Ponceña at Papa Luca in Puerto Rico. Excellent singer, Tito. And he hired me as well. So he had two singers in case that one singer left, the other one was still there.
Right. And this is how you started, really, here.
That's how I started, yeah, full-time as a musician in 1974 or 75. I'm not sure.
Right. From the start, you were politically engaged and you sang about political topics. You talk about, you were writing poems about what was happening in Panama when you were in high school. And Juan González, the song you referred to in your first album, is about the death of a guerrillero. Pablo Pueblo from 1977 is about this poor man who comes home and tired and hopeless after working all day. The politicians he voted for have never made his life better. Here's a bit of Pablo Pueblo for those who haven't heard it.
Regresa un hombre en silencio, de su trabajo cansado. Su paso no lleva prisa, su sombra nunca lo alcanza. No espera el barrio de siempre, con el farol en la esquina. Con la basura ya enfrente, y el ruido de la cantina. Pablo Pueblo.
So you've written song about class, about the struggles of people, about dictatorships and revolutions, about the desaparecidos in Latin America, etc. But you've always rejected the label of political singer or protest singer, and you've never wanted to be seen as somebody who sings political songs.
Yes.
Why?
Because political songs are propaganda, by definition. If you start singing about political ideology, you're not an artist. You're doing propaganda, basically. I try to be as close to a newspaper person as I can, and try. Of course, you can't really say that you're objective by writing songs that reflect a point of view. You have a point of view, but you can be balanced, and you have to be careful in how you write it, so it doesn't become a lie. And basically what I thought at the time was that music, and especially salsa music, was creating what did not exist at the time, and I did not see it at the time, which was this excuse or this vehicle for total strangers to meet and all of a sudden share a common ground.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that incredible possibility of having all these people who come from all these different walks of life in one place. Okay, so you can dance. Well, let's think too. Enhance the experience you're having right now, which is a contact. You're touching a total foreign, a stranger to you in sometimes intimate ways, because it's a contact dance.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden now I'm talking to you about a priest that was killed, or I'm talking to you about your mother that died of cancer, or I'm talking to you about the girlfriend that went away because you were black and she was white, or I'm going to talk to you about the gay guy who doesn't dare to say that he's gay because he may have reprisals. Some people had never heard songs that touched politics or political aspects before. And some of them got very upset with me, because they call me a communist, because I was like not using music only to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And they wrongly interpreted the direction of my criticism and ascribed it to a political ideology, which really pissed me off because I was always trying not to go there.
I was remembering Charlie Garcia, you know, the Argentine pop star.
Oh, yes, I do.
he once said, he was, you know, those questions, what advice would you give to young artists or young musicians? And he said that the only piece of advice he had was to not make compromises at the start, because people always thought that you had to compromise at the beginning,
yes,
to be able to be famous. But he said, by the time you're famous, you're not going to be able to walk out of that box.
Absolutely.
It's too late.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Very smart. My goal from the beginning was not to be famous, to become famous or rich. My goal from the beginning was to communicate, to present a position and create a conversation.
Singer Ruben Blades talking with Graciela Machkowski. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, the podcast. On each episode, Ina welcomes a different friend over to her Hamptons home to share stories about career, love, and life, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Guests include New York Times writer Frank Bruni, Jennifer Garner, restaurateur Danny Meyer, and The New Yorker's David Remick. David talks about his love of music and his obsession with Szechuan cooking videos on YouTube. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We'll continue now with the salsa legend Ruben Blades, who sat for a long interview this summer with Graciela Machkowski of The New Yorker. This year, Blades won his 11th Grammy Award. He's credited with bringing about a kind of socially aware songwriting to salsa. He's also been a government official and a popular actor. He was a lead actor on Fear the Walking Dead. And Ruben Blades continues looking for ways to push the bounds of his music.
So let's talk about jazz. So I attended your performance in 2014 with Wynton Marsalis at Jazz at Lincoln Center.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah.
That was great. I remember the beginning was mostly jazz, and then you started singing some of your classics, and then all these people who had been restless in their rooms, they just finally could dance.
Yeah.
And so everybody just jumped off their seats and started dancing on the sides of the aisles. It was wonderful. But I believe that was the, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if I understand it correctly, that was the origin of Sal Swing, this project of three albums that you recorded in 2021 with Roberto Delgado, the Panamanian big band leader. And Sal Swing is about the connections between Afro-Cuban music and jazz. Again, convergence, right? And connection. I wanted to listen to one song. I hope you find the choice right, but I chose The Way You Look Tonight.
Mm-hmm.
One day, when my ears grow old, and the world gets cold, I will feel the glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
It's so gorgeous. It's always so joyful.
But the thing again, to bring it into context, my father is a gambling man. So one day he showed up in the house with a record player. It was the biggest record player I've ever seen. And with the record player, it came some albums. And these albums were some of the songs that I picked when I did the Sal Swing. There was an album. There was a Tony Bennett record. There was, of course, a Sinatra album. There was a Sammy Davis Jr. album. So I learned to sing on top of the records. And that's why I lost my accent singing. And as a matter of fact, I learned how to breathe because I started mimicking Sinatra so that I could, I ended up learning how to breathe just by following what he was doing on his records. But the point is that the jazz Latin connection is an old one.
Right.
It's a very old one. In Panama, you have from Louis Russell that ended up being Louis Armstrong's band leader, Danilo Perez, who played with Wayne Shorter. So Carlos Enriquez is the bass player for Wynton Marsalis' Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. approached me to say, you know, would you like to do some shows with us? And we did, and it worked.
At one point between 2004 and 2009, you interrupted again your career as a musician for those, 5 years, to take on the role of Minister of Tourism in Panama. This was after you had run for president of Panama in 1994, which you didn't win, obviously. And when you came back from Panama, you took on an acting role in Fear the Walking Dead, a post-apocalyptic TV series, the spin-off of The Walking Dead, which lasted 8 seasons. I think it's coming to an end now.
Yes.
And you said you did it as a way to go back to relevancy. You said people were asking, is he dead?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true, but...
No, it is true.
Is it?
Sure.
And then this was not your first acting role. You've acted in like 30 movies and you've been, in Hollywood for a long time, but I wanted you to talk a little bit about this decision to be a killer in a zombie movie as a way to go back to popular culture.
There were many things. I mean, one of them was I went back to public service because it was a way to, I hope, to inspire the young in my country, Panama, to become involved in politics. Most people don't think, at least in Panama, to become involved in politics because they consider it that it's corrupt and it's... horrible. Mm-hmm. And I tell them it's corrupt and horrible because people like us don't participate.
Right.
You have to eliminate the space for the corruption. For 5 years, I didn't do any singing or writing or touring or doing movies or anything. For 5 years, I just stayed in the public service. I did not want to go first to be a minister of tourism. I wanted to work in the correctional system in Panama because that's what I had been involved with when I was in law school. The president felt that I would be more helpful in an area that was going to contribute to the national gross product, and they needed somebody there that can push it forward. But anyway, once I left Panama, and not having recorded and not having done anything, I didn't even have an agent anymore. I needed work. But it wasn't just the fact that people were going like, where is he? But it was also like I was thinking in more practical ways as well. For instance, to get the medical insurance of Screen Actors Guild. So I ended up being offered a role in this upcoming, wasn't a spinoff, but something that sprung from The Walking Dead. And what attracted me to the role was that it was a total opposite of me. It was a guy who had worked with the death squads in Salvador.
Daniel Salazar.
So that when the event occurred and death people were rising and killing living people for reasons that have never been totally explained. I could say that about the Trump candidacy. The thing is that his skills ended up becoming the thing to have to survive in this new apocalyptic world. And it provided me with that access, not just to audiences in this country, but also worldwide.
Right.
So all of a sudden you have somebody in Nigeria that maybe doesn't know about Pedro Navaja, and all of a sudden goes like, oh, Daniel Salazar sings? I didn't know that.
You've run for president in Panama, but how about your political participation here in the U.S.?
I wouldn't do it here because I would have to be a citizen.
You're still not?
I am not a citizen. I'm a resident because if I had become a citizen, then I could not participate in politics in Panama.
Of course, right. You've said that, coming back to the U.S., that Latinos have no political power to speak of because we act like tribes and we don't identify as one people.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that?
Basically, it's an interesting scenario. When you think about Latin America, you think about really the world. You know, in Latin America, you have white, black, brown. You can't really say that one group represents all groups because it's not true. So that's one very important difference. The second is that people who, like myself, ended up in this country came running from dictatorship or a scenario where we didn't have opportunities. When people arrive to the United States, most people don't want to talk about politics. they feel, you know what, I'm not going to rock the boat and I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to be quiet. So as a result of that, we don't have the political representation and or power or and or recognition. We're not even considered in films.
I think there's it's 4% of all acting roles that are played by Latinos.
But then when you go and see who goes most to the movies, Latinos. Hmm. Who eat more popcorn, Latinos? You know, who
drink more soda?
Well, if we're the top ones and going to the movies, we're sure eating more popcorn than anybody else. But I'm saying, where are we? When are we going to break away from the roles of narcotrafficking, a maid, illegal alien, hoodlum?
Right.
You know? So,
do you feel that you were able to break away from that?
I was able to say no, and I lost. I'll never forget. I lost a role in a movie called Q&A, and I turned it down because it was a drug dealer. And as a career move, it was not a wise move, because if I had done that role, which was a lead, I maybe would have been seen for something else.
Right.
But I could say no because I had the music. I'm not criticizing those who need to work and because they need to support themselves. I had an option that was brought to me by music, so I said no.
So my second question about staying relevant. You do a lot of collaboration with younger musicians, not just across genres, but also with people who are much younger and with much shorter careers. So you play with Calle 13, with Natalia Lafourcade. I love your song with Natalia Lafourcade. And if you ask my son, who is 12, about Rubén Blades, he will tell you that Blades is the guy who played with Stay Homas during the pandemic. Stay Homas from Stay Home, in case people don't know what we're talking about, was a group created during the COVID-19 lockdown in Barcelona. Three guys who play on their rooftop and invited artists to play with them via their cell phones. So all my son's friends, those kids, were listening to them on YouTube.
Yo que hasta ayer no conocí el dolor del que hablan las canciones. Me he olvidado de mí mismo, me asomo al abismo de mis pasiones.
I thought they were great. Melodically, I love where they go. They're very good musicians on their own right. So then through the net, I sent a message. Hey, guys, I'd love to do something with you. And then they called me. I saw him again last year in Cruel in the festival in Barcelona, and I sang with them live in Barcelona.
Oh, that's great.
They had 25,000 people, which is something. Again, I'm going like, well, this kid's going from being in a rooftop singing with a glass and with a can,
right,
to all of a sudden 25,000 people. They had their tour was bigger than mine.
That's great. Okay, Rubén, muchísimas gracias.
No, gracias a usted. Thank you all for listening.
Por la esquina del viejo barrio lo vi pasar.
Graciela Muchkowski speaking with Rubén Blades. I'm David Remnick. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time.
Pa' que no sepan en cuál de ellas lleva el puñal.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Imputabuele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Mike Kutchman, Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett.
And a special thanks this week to Alana Casanova Burgess.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.